Cause you're a sky, cause you're a sky full of stars. I'm gonna give you my heart. Cause you're a sky, cause you're a sky full of stars.
Dr. Greg, we want to look at some videos that are popular on YouTube. Our listeners have sent us these and asked you to comment on them. Our friend Robert Kuhn, you've been on his program, Closer to Truth.
Yes.
Has interviewed some philosophers, cosmologists, and he interviews Leonard Mlodinow in this particular video. It's a short segment here, and we'll get you to comment on it as we go. This is the rise of scientific atheism. You've quoted Mlodinow and referenced him as well in your work, so he is...
He co-authored the most recent book with Stephen Hawking called The Grand Design, and it was puzzling to me to know how much of that book really represented Hawking and how much really represented Mlodinow, because Hawking is so debilitated with Lou Gehrig's disease, it's hard to believe that he could have played much of an active role in the book. And so it makes one wonder whether the book is not more of a reflection of Mlodinow's own views, but I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay. Let's begin then with this interview, and we'll pause as we go.
The age-old questions of whether God exists or not. In recent times, the hard use of science, particularly in cosmology and physics, your fields, have been used to show that, at the very least, God is not necessary. How do you look upon the use of physics and cosmology to argue against the existence of God?
Well, I think that the history of science shows that God is not necessary to explain the universe. I don't think that, for instance, we now know that evolution can create us. We know how the universe got to be here through the theories of cosmology. We haven't ever come into a barrier where we said, then a miracle must have happened. In fact, we never see miracles in the lab.
I think that is an overconfidence that requires some sort of argument. My understanding of the contemporary theory of biological evolution is that it's grossly incomplete, and the whole origin of life scenarios have all broken down, that there is no good understanding, for example, of the origin of life. Moreover, there really isn't any good understanding of the explanatory mechanisms for the rise of biological complexity. The neo-Darwinian theory, based on random mutations and natural selection, proposes explanatory mechanisms for this, but they've never been shown to be adequate to account for the amount of biological complexity that we observe today. So, what he's saying represents a great confidence in the explanatory success of neo-Darwinian evolutionary theory, but I would like to see some justification offered for that. Similarly, when he says that cosmology has managed to explain where the universe came from, well, again, that's not really accurate unless you mean that our present universe came from earlier states of the universe, from a primordial Big Bang event, but it doesn't answer the ultimate question of where did the universe come from, period. Why does the universe exist instead of just nothing? So once again, there's an overconfidence that's being expressed here that needs some argument.
I hear that a lot, I'm sure you have too, about when you insert a miracle in your equations. There's a famous cartoon. It shows two scientists working all these equations, then in parentheses, then a miracle occurs, and then the equations continue.
That would be a good description of origin of life research today. Now, I want to make it clear, Kevin, that we're not advocating that approach.
Yeah.
To science. We're not talking about God of the gaps reasoning. Where you're inserting a miracle in the gap. We're simply saying that Mlodinow's assertions that science has managed to explain the evolution of biological complexity and where the universe came from are exaggerations it represents an overconfidence that isn't borne out by the facts.
Okay, let's continue then with this interview.
We see everything following the laws that we discover, or we discover, we create new laws. So I am a big believer in the idea that God is not necessary for the universe, that everything that happens follows the laws of nature, and I've never seen any evidence that that's not true.
Okay, now there he expresses his belief in the causal closeness of nature, but he doesn't give any evidence for it. He's making an assertion that miracles never happen, that nature is causally closed, and that God is not necessary, but he's not given any argument for that. On the contrary, one could present arguments and evidence for miracles, not only historically, but in the world today. Now, I'm not advocating that. Again, we're not going to get into God of the Gap's reasoning. We're asking whether he has succeeded in establishing his position, or is he simply expressing the faith of a naturalist in the causal closedness of the cosmos? And it seems to me that that is what we're hearing, is just the faith of a naturalist.
However, let me go from science to a more mathematical philosophical statement, which is that we haven't proved, science does not and cannot prove that there is no God. And I don't understand people who seem to believe that. Just because we are showing that we can have mathematical laws that describe nature doesn't mean that we're proving that, that God's not there. Maybe God created the laws. Maybe God was necessary to come up with the quantum principle.
Now, this represents a commendable modesty. What he's saying here is that even if the universe is causally closed and completely describable by mathematical and physical laws, that isn't itself an argument to say that God doesn't exist, that God didn't bring into existence the entire theater of natural causes operating according to deterministic laws. So that's commendable that he recognizes that.
I find it very hard to see how people could believe in the Bible, but on the other hand, I'm somewhat, religious. I go to synagogue sometimes. I'm more of what you would call an agnostic, but I see science as being separate and religious beliefs as being separate, and one doesn't prove the other.
Now, he's evidently Jewish from what he says about going to synagogue. And I would wonder what he thinks of the New Testament. When he says, I don't believe the Bible, that's painting in very broad strokes. Certainly there are things in the Bible that are hard to believe. But I wonder what he would think about the Jew, Jesus of Nazareth, and the history of his life and his teachings. Who does he think that Jesus of Nazareth was? I think there the historical credibility of the Gospels is very high, and that it's much easier to believe in the narratives of the Gospels than certain other parts of the Bible.
Well, so that would be a better starting point then.
Yes,
I
think
Jesus
so.
Of Nazareth.
Right, don't start with Noah and the Ark or the Tower of Babel. Yeah. Start with Jesus of Nazareth and the Gospels.
And when you're saying they're harder to believe, that doesn't mean that they didn't happen. It just means that, especially from a naturalistic framework, they may be very difficult for a person to overcome their naturalism or natural skepticism or something to believe in this intervention or these miraculous things.
Sure, and some parts of the Bible are more historically established than other parts. And I would say with regard to the New Testament, this is part of the Bible that has very high historical credibility.
All right, continuing.
Maybe I'll say one other thing, that one thing I do have trouble with are people on the other side, people who, they're scientific atheists and they're radical theists who don't want evolution to be taught or don't believe in the Big Bang. And I get very puzzled by that because, you know, I sat when I was, High Holidays came and I was in the synagogue, I was looking through the Chumash, it's the Torah, the Bible, and I was reading about a couple of things that I wonder if how these people, how they deal with that, where the Bible says, kill homosexuals. Maybe they, believe that homosexuality is wrong, but...
Here, I think he's misrepresenting the situation seriously. What the Old Testament law held was that someone engaged in homosexual behavior is committing a capital crime. The Mosaic law was a theocracy where God is the head of state. And so this represented a rule that isn't necessarily to be applied to states that are not theocracies, where God is the head of state. And it's not true that you just go out and kill homosexuals. The Bible doesn't condemn a person for having a homosexual orientation. What it proscribes is sexual activity of an adulterous nature, or including homosexual nature. And the fact that this is found to be morally acceptable to us today, I think, is just a reflection of our cultural relativity. In God's eyes, these were serious sins that were punishable by death. It had a very different value system than we have today. It held that someone engaged in this sort of activity has committed a capital crime and therefore should be killed.
Also says things like, if your child is disrespectful, kill him.
Again, I think this needs to be parsed out. He doesn't give us the reference. We need to look at that more closely. I think in many cases, what you have in these Old Testament laws are idealizations, but they may have never, in fact, been enforced. I don't know of any place in the Old Testament where it suggests that someone was executed for this sort of crime. I think that these laws were probably idealized sorts of laws saying, obey your parents, be respectful to your parents. But I don't know of any case where these sorts of idealizations were enforced to say that people should actually be executed because of this.
That was the punishment for disrespect of a child toward the father. Told my daughter Olivia this, by the way, and she said, that's okay, because it doesn't say anything about girls. But somehow people who believe in the Bible find a way to dismiss those things, and yet they have trouble dismissing that the earth was created in 7 days and that people were put on the earth and evolution isn't true. And I think that if you're going to believe in the Bible today, there's a lot of stuff you have to dismiss, explain away, or whatever, in the realm of moral issues. And that you should also use those same techniques to explain away the wrong physical picture that the Bible gives of how we and the world got here.
I agree that the creation account in Genesis shouldn't be taken literally to be six consecutive 24-hour day account of creation. But you don't use the same hermeneutical techniques in interpreting the Genesis story of creation that you use in interpreting these moral commands. I would see these moral commands as being a provisional and temporary setup for the people of Israel in a theocracy that expressed sort of idealizations in many cases of God's disapprobation of, for example, disobedience to parents or homosexual activity. But that doesn't mean that these are meant to be laws that would be transcultural and binding in all societies.
Yeah, to say that you find ways to get around something or explain it away, does that mean you can't do good exegesis?
Right, I think that's pejorative. That's loaded language. I don't think it's a matter of trying to get around it. I mean, indeed, with what I said about homosexual behavior being a capital crime in ancient Israel, that's simply true, and that just reflects a different value system than some people have today. Our culture has become very permissive in the area of sexual ethics, and so we find it unconscionable that God might disapprove of homosexual activity. But if the Bible is true, he does, and regards this as a serious, gross sin. And the fact that it was regarded as a capital crime in ancient Israel is a measure of how much God detests this sin. It is abominable to him. And that's evidenced in the severe legal penalties that were attached to this kind of activity in ancient Israel.
And so as a scientist and as a physicist and knowing everything, how do you approach the concept of the possibility of some spiritual or some additional factor You're saying it's not necessary, you don't need it, but it could possibly...
It's not necessary, I can't disprove it. And for me, as a scientist, and not just a scientist by training or profession, but in my heart as a scientist, I tend not to believe things that there's no evidence for. But it's not always true. I do believe, for instance, in aliens. I believe that there's life on other planets, and I think there's no evidence of that, and we don't understand the origin of life on Earth well enough to say how probable it is that on another star life would form. But in my heart, for some reason, I find myself believing that. But that's rare for me. I usually believe things based on evidence, and I've never seen evidence in my life for God. In fact, I've seen evidence against God in some ways, because my parents went through the Holocaust. Their families were all slaughtered. And it's hard to see how God would have made that decision.
Well, that's how the interview segment here ends.
That's really bizarre, isn't it, that he believes in aliens, even though he says he has no evidence for it, but he just finds he believes in his heart that extraterrestrial life exists. But he doesn't apparently find it in his heart to think that God exists the way many people do. I mean, if he thinks he's rational in believing in aliens, why isn't it rational to believe in God? And obviously, you know from my work that I think there is good evidence for God that he hasn't considered. And I've responded to the book, The Grand Design, where they try to explain away some of that evidence unsuccessfully, I think. You can look at our popular articles online to see my response to the book by Hawking and Mladenov on the Grand Design. And of course, we've talked extensively about the problem of evil and suffering, and that God would not permit something like the Holocaust to happen without morally sufficient reasons for doing so. And so what Dr. Mladenov would need to show is that it's either impossible or improbable that God had morally sufficient reasons for allowing the Holocaust to happen. And I don't know how he could ever hope to prove such a thing.
Bill, as we wrap up this podcast today, it seems that the biggest positive in this, would you agree, that he says that really the existence of God is not in the realm of science as most people think. He does allow for the fact that God could exist, but that if you're asking him to prove it scientifically, he couldn't do that.
Yeah, I suppose he deserves faint praise for that. I mean, that's so basic. I think it's rather that those who somehow think that because the universe is causally closed, that's a disproof of God, are incompetent thinkers and bad philosophers. What Mladenov has merely done is shown that he's not a bad philosopher by acknowledging that the causal closeness of the universe is not an argument against the existence of God. So I would give him faint praise for that. But I think much of what he says about the ability of science to explain everything in the natural world is grossly over-exaggerated. And the fact that he sees no evidence for the existence of God suggests that he hasn't grappled seriously with the arguments of natural theology.
From the birds that sing in the tallest trees to the human life of you and me. From the desert sands to the place we stand, He is God.